This program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
Good morning on this tropical March day. Very unusual. Happy St. Patrick's Day. 70 degrees, humidity in the air. And Tom Schroyer back in studio today after a couple of weeks away. Good to see you, Tom.
It's good to see you too, Steve. And we're from the tropics and back to the tropics, as you say. It's really unbelievable. What an out-of-body experience we're having here.
It is extraordinary weather, record-breaking weather as well. And I think we have a record-breaking appearance on the program today.
We do. We have the return of the vaunted Kevin M. Bush, the lawyer's lawyer and the chief operating officer of Moss and Barnett. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be back.
Of course, we have long admired your programming on this show, and our audience has deeply appreciated that. And we're really making a stretch play here today to talk about something that's near and dear to the heart of most lawyers, and that is the language of the law.
I thought we'd try something a little different and explore a bit the ways that lawyers talk and write. There's no question that lawyers communicate in ways that are a bit different from the ways that non-lawyers communicate.
You think?
I think. And in fact, it's been almost exactly 4 years since we started this show, and we've never really explained why we talk funny.
And it's really an oversight on our part here and at the programming level for this show because, you know, of course, it's really the essence in some measure of the first year of law school is learning the language of the law and having all of those good grammatical and literary rules that we learned in grammar school through high school and college beat out of us by law professors. Isn't that how it works?
It does work that way, and you can even see it in Steve. I think after 4 years, he's starting to talk a little funny, too.
Well, I've always wondered about that, though, and I'm glad we're doing this topic because I'm sure people, why not plain English? Why not just use terms that everyone understands?
It's really an excellent point. I remember, and both, as you know, Steve here, you can see in the studio, both Kevin and I have brought along with us our respective vintage editions of the Black's Law Dictionary, and this is a dictionary of dictionaries. I mean, these things run for, you know, the poundage on these things is really quite remarkable.
I referred to it as a heavy artillery because they are large books.
Well, I'm touting the revised fourth edition from 1977. How about you, Kevin?
I have the eighth edition today, but that's still one edition out of date.
It's skinnier than mine. What happened? Did they try to simplify the law?
No, smaller print.
All right, and of course, Black's Law Dictionary was a staple in the day for every aspiring law student, at least in our era and prior. And of course, now it's out of print; it's all electronic.
I still like to print copy myself, but you're right; it is available electronically. Now, I wanted to call our segment today "How to Talk Like a Minnesota Lawyer." But I wasn't able to figure out how to say "You betcha" in Latin. But we'll use a little Latin today. And probably a little bit of a very old-fashioned form of French called law French. And I thought maybe that's where we should start. Why do lawyers use these foreign phrases, particularly French and Latin, when English, as Steve says, would do just fine?
Aren't they? I think we use it to impress people.
That's probably a wrong reason, although I do think it is one of the most common. It's likely misguided because if the audience consists of other lawyers or judges, the audience has already heard the language before and particularly won't be impressed if it's misused, mispronounced, or misspelled, which is pretty common. And if the audience consists of non-lawyers, it's just as likely that the audience is going to be frustrated as impressed. So I'm not sure that's a good reason. Let me suggest one good reason. Steve, you asked why do we use these funny phrases? And one very good reason is efficiency. Many of these phrases have been in use for hundreds of years, maybe even close to 1,000 years. And when we use them, we bring with that very short phrase whole paragraphs, even whole pages of additional meaning that comes with just a very short phrase. So, Tom, when you are called to be part of a litigation in another state where you're not licensed, what's one of the very first phrases that comes to your mind?
Well, I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce it. Thank you for setting me up on that one. But pro hoc vice, or I think some would say pro hoc vice.
Pro hoc vice, or pro hoc as it's sometimes even shortened, is a Latin phrase that we'd translate, if we tried to translate, as something like for this turn or for this event. Doesn't tell us very much, but because of this long history of this phrase, it tells you not only that you can practice in that other state, but it also tells you a bit about how you go about becoming admitted and what the limitations are. It's a very efficient use for just a couple of words.
That's true, and I would second that, in fact, that the language of the law, these terms of art that we're going to talk about, I don't think they're unique to the law, and I think they serve the same purpose in the legal profession as they do in other businesses, trades, or professions, and that is they provide maybe the insiders, but certainly them, with an effective and efficient means of clearly communicating within the anointed.
And it's a shorthand that gets a lot of material on the page or out into the message very quickly. Here's another reason. Sometimes these phrases that we use are actually very difficult to translate into English. Cecile says, why don't we just use the English version, which is a very good question. But sometimes the phrase doesn't translate very well. A year or two ago, I was asked to consult in a lawsuit that required us to apply a Minnesota statute, and that statute had embedded in it a Latin phrase that for the statute had been translated into English. And it was a good enough literal translation, but it left an awful lot behind.
What was it?
In personam was the phrase. In personam, a Latin phrase that is actually very difficult to translate, but it means on account of a personal obligation, in effect. And one of the other lawyers in the case didn't understand that it had been translated from Latin and developed his whole theory of the case based on a completely wrong reading of the statute. And it was quite a while before we got the case back on track.
You know, one of my favorite examples of that process you're talking about is the name of a whole body of law, the tort law. I mean, what is a tort?
That's, again, a hard one to translate, but probably comes from a word that's close to twisted or tortured, and that means a civil wrong.
Exactly. So it means just anything that the law deems to be wrong. And so it's a wonderful short little word that certainly signals something's afoot, and I guess we know it when we see it.
Right. And if we've read the very long volumes that come out on what is a tort.
Right. So also, doesn't the language of the law sometimes add an elegance, a certain persuasiveness to legal writing and contract drafting?
Sometimes the phrases have been around so long and simply sound so good that it's a shame not to use them at least once in a while. One of my favorites in this category is nunc pro tunc. Nunc pro tunc, which we'd literally translate as now for then, and Steve would say retroactively, but somehow it just comes out just right in the right circumstance.
Well, I favor E tu Brute myself.
That works too.
We will take a break. By the way, do you need to memorize that dictionary before you take the bar exam?
No.
Oh, okay. It's not part of the – does the bar exam include some of these terms, or is it just part of getting through law school?
Well, the bar exam certainly will use any number of terms that we're going to talk about today or that are built into Black's Law Dictionary. But it has thousands of pages that would never be touched on the bar exam.
All right, fair enough. We're going to take a break. We have more on the way. Great topic today. A peek behind the curtain, so to speak. Tom Schroyer, Kevin Bush, the language of the law. By the way, for more on today's program and all our other programs, feel free to go online. We have a brand new website. And it is a good one. It is Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. Once again, that website again, Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett's attorneys help to found and remain active in the Minnesota Legal Advice Clinics and similar organizations, including the Fund for the Legal Aid Society?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, each and every Saturday between 11 and noon. Tom Schroyer is our host. Glad to have Tom back in studio today. Kevin Bush returns. Great topic today. The language of the law is in the spotlight. And during the break, we were talking about television and movies. And there's a television show that stands out that used a legal term, which amounts to be buyer beware. It's the Brady Bunch. Greg Brady bought his first car. It was a total jalopy, terrible car. And he received a piece of advice from his dad, a Latin term, which means buyer beware. And that is?
Caveat emptor.
Right. And that was the theme of the show. And I remember as a kid, that was maybe the first big Latin legal term many people of my age ever learned.
Well, and of course, I think it points out, as our studio producer here, Dennis Matusik, was saying, you know, he uses it on his eBay ads, and of course, it carries, what, huge significance, right? It's like a big stop sign in cyberspace when people read that, and they have to think, what does that mean, even if they don't know, or if they do know, they're duly impressed.
I'm sure they're impressed when Dennis uses it.
Absolutely.
But as we talked about in our UCC shows over the last couple of years, the UCC actually says the buyer has some protections. So caveat emptor doesn't really provide the legal rule here.
But when Greg went out and bought that car that sounded too good to be true, it does carry that weight, though. It has a lot of meanings about the buyer beware, and you're not sure what you're getting into here. And that really illustrates the point of how these terms can boil things down to a couple of words, but it carries a lot of weight and a lot of meaning for people,
yes,
even lay people.
Yes, it does. Well, one of the issues that may come up is listeners or readers of legal material aren't so concerned about the types of words used, but the number of words used.
A little verbosity.
One of the great ironies in legal writing is that one of the most common documents we write is a brief.
Right, a set of arguments to the court to persuade the judge to see a case our way.
And a brief is almost never brief.
You know, there's an old saw in the legal business that a client asks a lawyer to prepare a brief, and the brief comes out, and it's 100 pages long, and the client says, boy, I didn't want to pay for a 100-page brief. Can you cut that down to 30 pages? And the lawyer says, well, it'll cost you a lot more.
This is an area where maybe we can use a quote that's been attributed to a number of very good writers over the years. It goes along something like this. I'm sorry this letter is so long. I didn't have time to write a short one. And it's very true that a short, precise, and very carefully worded document can take longer to write than a long one. Now, just in defense of lawyers here, we are dealing often with very complex topics. We have to deal with them precisely, and that requires a lot of words sometimes. We know that other lawyers and judges may pick apart our documents word for word, maybe even years later, and we need to anticipate the types of questions that will come up, and we need to try to have them handled in a way that does not allow for ambiguity later on. The courts have been frustrated with this for years. Tom, I don't know if this was true when you started. When I started, the courts were just starting to implement page limits on documents filed with the court. And it's probably not coincidental that was just about the time that word processing systems were available to regular folks, including lawyers, so that the documents could get longer and longer, and the courts didn't like that. I do remember standing in front of one of our federal judges here who was peering over his glasses at the assembled lawyers saying, counsel, there's a 35-page limit here. I'll read the first 35 pages or the last 35 pages or every other page until I get to 35, but I won't read any more.
I know that, Judge.
Maybe you've got that speech too. We actually, and more recently, of course, with a lot of the word processing tricks with different font sizes and scale text and so on, the courts have had to become more sophisticated. So now there's a word count restriction in number of documents filed with the court.
And let me tell you, as someone who is a professional trial attorney, litigation attorney, that's the remedy that we can't hide from. That is counting the words is just something that there's no way to get around it. Either you have the words or you don't. You can't squeeze more font in or different font or use abbreviations to cover it.
But I'm sure in complicated cases that has to be a gigantic challenge.
The courts simply don't allow anything more.
It is what it is.
But I think that does get back to the point that Kevin's getting at here in some measure, which is because of those limits on pagination or word numbering in this case now, it's important to use terms of art that have well-known meaning that bring a whole, a boxcar or even a freight train full of meaning with them.
And certainly if the courts require us to generates shorter documents, our work product may be better. It forces us to cut out the clutter and focus on those things that are most important. Now, lawyers have developed some habits, some may call them bad habits, over the years that do lead to longer documents. Let me give a very simple one, but it is symptomatic. The lawyers tend to use words and figures when presenting numbers. So the number 10 is presented as TEN plus 1 and 0 in parentheses. Now, if we stop to think about that for a moment.
A lot of times it's $10.00 to make it clear there's no pennies involved.
Absolutely. But if we think about it for a moment, we'd realize that we're not actually conveying any more information by repeating the number twice. And if it's a long number or a percentage or a fraction, it can lead to some real clunky writing that doesn't convey more information. Another habit that lawyers have is repeating the same word or several words for the same concept. Here's one that Tom and I see a lot. Send us a true and correct copy.
Well, Kevin, I actually use that a lot.
Well, we all do because that's what sounds normal to us. But if we stopped and thought about it, could there actually be a copy that's true but not correct or correct but not true? And almost certainly not.
Often my couplet there is true and complete.
Well, then we should add correct in there too.
Thank you.
But you're running a follow the word count again, I suppose. That's probably a good thing at the end of the day.
Yes, it makes our writing more precise if we can pay attention to the numbers of our words.
And we're going to have more on the language of the law. Tom Schroyer hosting Kevin Bush today in studio. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett each and every Saturday between 11 and noon. For more on today's program and all our programs, feel free to go online, a brand new website, Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. Minnesota Law continues, presented by Moss and Barnett. Today, the language of the law. Tom Schroyer back in studio hosting Kevin Bush. And fascinating. I didn't know, really, before the break we talked about that the judges put strict limits on it. Is that judge by judge? Is that depend on the court, whether it's district court, federal court? How are those rules written on the wording and the number of words you can use in a brief?
Well, there isn't anything that addresses the selection of the words or the choice of words by the lawyers, but rather the word count limits on each brief are enshrined in written rules of the local rules of each of the courts, state and federal. So they are available for listeners online. All of the court's rules are posted either at the U.S. District Court websites or at the Minnesota Supreme Court website.
So there isn't a judge that would say, well, I'll allow more. It's strictly set.
Oh, well, I didn't say that. And, in fact, lawyers are often making motions to the court for extensions of the amount of space or wording available, and always on the grounds that you mentioned, Steve, that our case is too complex and magnificent to be expressed in just a mere 50,000 words or less. So, so you know, we talk about the use of words, and lawyers, Kevin, are actually rather poetic at times, right? They use couplets and doublets to express concepts, and there's they have a certain ring when they use them.
Sometimes even triplets.
I was on with John Hines on the Dave Lee Show on Thursday and mentioned that to him, and he joked that, yes, lawyers do say a lot at times, don't they? So what do you say to that, Mr. Bush?
There is a whole series of traditional doublets, as we call them, sometimes triplets. These are phrases that our listeners will be very familiar with. Legal and valid, null and void, cease and desist, aid and abet, due and payable, right title and interest. All of these come from a very old tradition. When the British common law was being developed, the lawyers were speaking to a mixed audience of French and English speakers.
Interesting.
So this was almost inclusive language at the time. These phrases, the doublets will have both a French and an English word put back to back.
They're bilingual.
They were bilingual at the time. Now, the words themselves have carried forward in English. I'm pretty sure the French listeners today would not understand either of the words. But the words end up almost being one word for lawyers. It's hard for us to say null without saying void, or legal without saying valid.
Or have without saying hold.
Fair enough. Due and payable. It just they do have a certain rhythm to them, and yet they don't convey any more meaning than just the single word out of the doublet or triplet.
So they're not in there just for rhyme or rhythm?
They're there really just because of history.
You might say then the lawyers are the first rap artists, eh?
I wasn't going to say that.
Now, as this evolved over time, what I'm wondering is the English language has evolved over time. New words are being added to the dictionary. Are new words added to, for instance, a Black's Law Dictionary? I mean, has it evolved? Have some words gone by the wayside or phrases?
Certainly that happens. If we were to pull up Tom's fourth edition of Black's Law Dictionary, there are many phrases in there, particularly the Latin and French phrases, that we would not see in the current edition. They simply don't show up anymore. But there are these phrases that we see a lot, and they have not changed in hundreds of years.
And you know, Kevin, I might jump in and say, to some degree, it seems to me that's a function not just of lawyers and the kinds of issues that we've been talking about so far, but also because the law is so grounded and rooted in tradition and history under the common law, which depends on case law precedent, prior decisions deciding what our law is and have to be applied later. And if you look back for not too many years, you'll see cases, court opinions, loaded up with these Latin phrases. And if you don't have Black's Law Dictionary, it's impossible to decode them.
That's true, and you also point out another aspect. Because these have such history, lawyers really don't want to change them because then they're not sure whether the history will come along.
Well, who wants to be the first one to jump into the cold water, so to speak, of breaking out of some paradigmatic coupleting or tripleting?
That's always a challenge. I thought maybe we'd switch to a different topic here and look at some phrases that lawyers use. And the first grouping that I have is phrases that lawyers use among themselves particularly. Steve said he wants to look behind the curtain a little bit. So these are the phrases that lawyers might use in the office or among themselves. And I'm going to start with Tom's favorite, which is, a lawyer who represents himself or herself has a fool for a client.
I resemble that remark.
Two of the very important attributes that a lawyer can bring to a relationship with a client is impartiality and perspective. The lawyer needs to be able to tell the client things that the client doesn't want to hear. The lawyer needs to be able to focus on the current issue as opposed to the last 20 years of history that the client might try to bring to bear. If the lawyer is the client, those attributes are lost.
Exactly. And so the law, the language of the law provides a bit of objectivity. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, not so much that, but the lawyer needs to, if the lawyer is representing himself, it's difficult to do as good a job.
We have more on the language of the law. Tom Schroyer, Kevin Bush. Today it is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, here on News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett attorney Clifford A. Taney Jr. went on to fame while serving during World War II as general counsel to the super-secret nuclear development program of the U.S. Army, known as the Manhattan Project?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Kevin Bush, Tom Schroyer in studio. The language of the law, Tom.
Kevin Bush, talking about the language of the law. We're addressing some of the phrases that seem to get a lot of currency among lawyers and even lay people. We talked about a lawyer being a fool who has herself or himself for a client. Another one, Kevin, that judges, or rather law professors, used a lot when I went to law school anyway, is the phrase, hard facts make bad law.
That's a little hard to interpret unless you're in there. And maybe it's easier to understand if we say sad facts make bad law. Think of the saddest case you can. Maybe a single parent with a very sick child who was just denied insurance coverage. The court's going to do the best job the court can do to find a way to help that party win.
Correct. No doubt about it.
And we want the court to do that. We want the court to have that discretion. The problem is, in the next case that's presented, the plaintiff may not be as compelling a plaintiff, but will want the same sorts of stretch and bend of the law that the court applied for the sad facts.
And so the law gets stretched in ways that may ultimately prove to be, not only counterintuitive, but self-defeating.
And can really end up with some really bad public policy because these sad facts led the court to come up with a decision that has long-term implications that maybe we don't like.
And so in that sense, the phrase hard facts make bad law is perfectly apt.
It is. I think the courts are fairly aware of that when they are faced with these tough decisions.
Another favorite of mine is in Latin, lex ignorantia non excusitatis. What would you say to that, Mr. Bush?
I'd have to look that one up. I'd prefer ignorance of the law is no defense. Steve might like that better, too. This is particularly applicable in criminal law, but it also applies in other areas, civil law as well, that the fact that I don't know that something is against the law does not excuse me from compliance with it. Now, the question is whether this is realistic. Think about this. In Minnesota alone, our Minnesota statutes consist of 12 volumes, about 1,500 pages each, 12 volumes at 1,500 pages. Minnesota rules, which are the regulations from our state agencies, are 10 volumes, about 1,200 pages each. And Tom was doing the math to see that's about 30,000 pages total. And it is simply impossible for anybody, even of carefully trained lawyer, to understand all of that.
And I might note you haven't counted the wall in our library that's full of the United States Code and the Code of Federal Regulations, plus literally we don't have room for all of the court decisions that have been published over the years, which also constitute the law and literally fill libraries.
Or any local regulations, of which there are many. So ignorance of the law is no defense, but the courts will tend to give a little bit of leeway to a party who couldn't reasonably be expected to understand all the details.
Yes, and of course now there's a bit of a movement anyway to try to start paring down some of the overgrowth and underbrush out of the thicket of statutes and regulations that you've talked about in an effort to simplify it and to make it more accessible to everyone.
I wouldn't hold my breath.
No, I know. And so, Kevin, another point we wanted to address here was the use of the language of the law to interpret or figure out what is being expressed by parties when they write a contract or an agreement.
We always hope that our contracts and statutes are completely free of ambiguity, but they never are. They never anticipate every possible situation that can come up. So we have a whole series of expressions and rules that help us understand how documents and statutes should be read.
Aren't these just traps for the unwary and the unwitting, however? Aren't these devices used by lawyers to snare people who don't know all of these little ins and outs?
That's a possible interpretation, but another way of looking at it is we have to get to an answer when we're faced with an ambiguity, so we should have some rules at least to get to that point.
Sure. What are some of the common rules that the courts apply to interpreting the language of the law?
Well, I'm going to try a Latin one on you here. How about expressio unius est exclusio alterius?
Does that mean that the expression of the one is the exclusion of the other?
And that's the way Steve would put it.
Yes.
An example here, for instance, if we have a document that refers to red and white but not blue, it may be a fair interpretation that blue is excluded from that listing because we've expressed some grouping but not others.
And what if it says, including without limitation, red and white?
Lawyers have figured that out over the years to throw in the phrase, including without limitation, to reverse this standard Latin interpretation rule.
So for every rule, there's a counter rule?
Almost always, and sometimes the rules are applied after the fact to justify a particular result.
You had some language I know that you were sharing with me before the show got underway here from an actual contract you came across recently where a lawyer was trying to cover all of these bases in some contract drafting. I thought it might be kind of fun to hear that very quickly.
All right, what have we got? And then we've got a break coming up.
Well, the contract was saying A sells, let's just say it was a car, A sells a car to B. The contract came in as A sells, delivers, sets over, grants, conveys, assigns, and transfers all right title and interest to the car to B.
Excellent. Great legal craftsmanship.
And at the end of the day, sells would probably be enough. Most reasonable people would say he sold the car.
Correct.
We'll be back. The Language of the Law, Tom Schroyer and Kevin Bush. By the way, for more on today's Minnesota Law program, go to Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. The Language of the Law today on Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, Tom Schroyer and Kevin Bush. Final segment, Tom.
Thanks, Steve. When I cut the spot for announcing our show today, I said that the show would race ipsa loquitur, and I drew a chuckle from the producer who was recording it for me. But Kevin then accused me of using that phrase ungrammatically. Now, Kevin, what does it mean?
Race ipsa loquitur literally translates, the thing speaks for itself.
Why would the law need such an awkward phrase?
I don't think it's awkward. I think it's elegant, Tom. But this is an interesting aspect of the law. Sometimes it's simply too complicated and too time-consuming to prove up every component of a case, and the court will say if you get close enough, if you've proven up enough of the parts, enough of the steps, then the rest of it falls into place. The rest of it speaks for itself. So res ipsa loquitur.
So it's a way for a party to make up for some gaps in its proof or evidence, and it gets close enough to proving its point, the court says, you've got it.
Right.
All right. Do you have any other, quickly, any other favorite little bon mots from legal maxims in Latin?
Well, we certainly should mention ex post facto. Many people have heard of that. It's actually in the U.S. Constitution twice, I think, in Latin.
I didn't know that.
It was not translated. And it means we would translate it after the fact, but it really means on account of an event after the fact.
And we are out of time. Tom Schroyer, Kevin Bush, The Language of the Law. Always a pleasure to see you, Kevin. Tom, another great show next week between 11 and noon.
We have David Beek returning to talk about an ongoing process of changing in the patent law for the purpose of making patent applications less expensive and for getting the patent law out of the court system and back to the U.S. Patent Office.
Very good. That is next Saturday between 11 and noon, Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. For more on today's program, feel free to go online, the website. We've got a brand new one for you, Moss and Barnett. On WCCO.com. Minnesota Law, Saturdays between 11 and noon. Thanks to Kevin Bush, Tom Schroyer, and our studio coordinator, Dennis Matuzak. I'm Steve Thompson.